morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Thursday, February the 10th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. The World Health Organization says that insecurity and bureaucratic difficulties are preventing medical supplies and other crucial relief from reaching millions of people in northern Ethiopia.
WHO is preparing to airlift critically needed medicines, medical supplies, and equipment to Tigray.
The International Court of Justice has ordered Uganda to pay reparations of $325 million to the Democratic Republic of Congo.
This global sum includes $225 million U.S. dollars for damage to persons, $40 million U.S. dollars for damage to property, and $60 million U.S. dollars for damage related to natural resources.
And Mali's army has confirmed that it took part in a joint attack last week with French and European forces that killed at least 20 Islamist militants. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. And for our top story, the International Court of Justice has ordered Uganda to pay $325 million to the Democratic Republic of Congo as reparations for Uganda's invasion of the DRC in the late 1990s. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
Wednesday's ruling from the International Court of Justice aims to settle a long-running political and financial dispute between Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. 7 years ago, the court ruled Uganda must compensate the DRC for its 1998 invasion of the country during the Second Congo War. Congo asked for $11 billion in damages. Uganda said that amount would ruin its economy. So, after failed negotiations, the sides came back to the ICJ. Judge Joanne Donohue read the verdict awarding Congo $325 million.
This global sum includes $225 million U.S. dollars for damage to persons, $40 million U.S. dollars for damage to property, and $60 million U.S. dollars for damage related to natural resources.
DR Congo had also sought reparations for intentional destruction and looting and the restitution of national property and resources. The total sum is to be paid in annual installments of $65 million due in September each year from 2022 to 2026. The court also ruled that should Uganda delay making the payments, an annual interest rate of 6% on each installment shall accrue on any overdue amounts. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
And still in Uganda, Halima Atumani reports that the author facing trial for criticizing the son of President Yoweri Museveni has fled the country. That is according to his lawyer.
Aaron Kiza, the lawyer for Kakwenza Rukira Bashaija, told VOA that the author fled the country Wednesday, 2 days after a court declined to release his passport. In a telephone interview, Kiza elaborated on his client's whereabouts.
He is in Rwanda, like 4 to 5 hours ago. He's trying to coordinate his way. That's how he got out of Uganda, and finally he will find his way to Europe.
Kakwenza had asked the court to release his passport so he could visit Germany to receive an award from the Writers Association PEN International and to receive treatment after his alleged torture while in Ugandan military custody. Kakwenza felt he had no choice but to flee the country, according to his lawyer.
The most important rule is the rule of life, and he had to choose between going with a passport or taking care of his life, and he has chosen the latter. After being tortured and denied a passport to rule out to poisoning following several injections he received while in military detention.
Late last month, the German ambassador to Uganda, Matthias Schauer, wrote to a Ugandan court asking that Kakwenza be allowed to travel to Germany. In response, Uganda's State Minister for Foreign Affairs responded with a protest letter, saying the ambassador's letter was a clear interference in the internal affairs of Uganda. Kakwenza was arrested in December 2021 and detained in a military facility for 2 weeks before he was sent to a government prison. He was released on bail last month, but still faced trial on charges of offensive communication for insulting Lieutenant General Muhoozi Kainerugaba, son of President Yoweri Museveni. The general is seen as Museveni's possible successor in 2026 elections. In a Twitter message Wednesday, the president's son said he had spoken to Rwanda's president, Paul Kagame, and said that, according to Kagame, Kakwenza is not in Rwanda. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
The COVID-19 pandemic has exposed stark vaccine inequities among high and low-income nations and also underscored Africa's dependence on outside countries for shots. However, a new initiative in Senegal hopes to reduce the inequity and make the continent more vaccine self-reliant. Anika Hamschlag reports from Dakar, Senegal.
Senegal administered its first doses to the public in March 2021, months after COVID-19 vaccines had become available in the West. Since then, supplies have repeatedly run dry in Senegal and other African countries that have relied on the international community for the vaccines. Today, just 11% of Africans are vaccinated, compared to 64% in the U.S. and 72% in the U.K. But scientists aim to change that. The Pasteur Institute of Dakar has partnered with the Germany-based BioNTech to build a production facility for its COVID-19 vaccines. Amadou Sall is the director of the Pasteur Institute of Dakar.
So the need to make sure that we have control over supplies is something that is critically important in terms of health security. Having a different level of protection in different parts of the world won't help actually control and end this pandemic.
Africa currently imports 99% of all its vaccines. The new facility is due to open later this year and produce 300 million COVID-19 inoculations annually. South Africa has announced a similar partnership with Moderna. The Institute hopes to manufacture vaccines not just for the next pandemic, but also for endemic diseases such as measles and polio. Antoine Diatta is the vaccine quality control manager at the Pasteur Institute. He says the standards are indeed getting higher and higher. It requires a level of human resources and skills that are extremely high as well. It's not always within reach or easily found in Africa because it's new technology, he says. But the Institute already produces yellow fever vaccines. Scientists there have been manufacturing them for decades. Dr. Ousseynou Badjan is the director of Senegal's expanded immunization program. The yellow fever vaccine was developed here and produced by the Pasteur Institute, he says. So they have a certain expertise in the domain of vaccine development. There's nothing to prevent them from producing another that's developed elsewhere. Misinformation about COVID-19 vaccines has run rampant throughout Africa, Bajan added. So vaccines made in Africa by Africans could help increase trust and the number of people willing to get the shot. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
Kenya will be sitting out the Winter Olympics this time around that are taking place in Beijing, after the country's hopefuls either failed to qualify or pulled out of the games due to lack of financial support. The ice hockey team did not have a place to train after East Africa's only ice rink shut down in 2020 because of the pandemic. Brenda Molina reports from Nairobi.
In a sunken parking lot in Nairobi, Kenya's central business district, Kenya's ice hockey team, the Ice Lions, train on the pavement. That has been their routine for the last 2 years as they try to keep their skills sharp while denied access to ice. Thousands of miles away, the Beijing Winter Olympics are going on without them, something that weighs heavily on Ice Lions member Hassan Ali. The 22-year-old Ali says the Winter Olympics would have been the highlight of his and his teammates' athletic careers.
My teammates, they kind of feel sad because, like, most of us wanted to be there to represent our country, Kenya, but so we are not there, so some are sad.
The Ice Lions have not had access to the region's only ice rink since it was closed in 2020 due to the coronavirus pandemic. The government ordered the suspension of all sporting activities and the closure of entertainment venues. But even before that happened, Ben Azagere, the Ice Lions team captain, says promoting hockey in Kenya was difficult due to lack of financial support.
The facility we are using is commercial, so you have to pay for the facility, and most of the athletes at the same time cannot afford to pay for it.
Kenya's National Olympic Organizing Committee, also known as NOC, is responsible for coordinating Kenya's international sporting events. Committee officials admit that a lack of funding has made it difficult for Kenya to participate at this Winter Games. Kenya took part in the 2018 Winter Olympics and had hoped to send three individual athletes and the hockey team to this year's event. NOC's Secretary General Francis Mutuku says the cost of supporting teams at the Winter Olympics is prohibitive for a tropical country like Kenya, but suggests that may change.
We've also engaged our Ministry of Sports, Culture and Heritage, and they have also agreed with us that there should be a little bit more focus on the winter sports so that even if we are not going to be competitive for podium finish, the fact that Kenya will be represented and that our kind of flag will be flown in such an important international event, that will be good for us.
The hockey team is hoping the ice rink will reopen soon so that it can resume training and pursue its Olympic dreams. The next chance comes at the 2026 Winter Games in Italy. Brenda Molinya for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Mali's army has confirmed that it took part in a joint attack last week with French and European forces that killed at least 20 Islamist militants. The attack in southern Mali went ahead despite rising tensions between Mali's government and the country's former colonial power. Annie Reisenberg reports from Bamako.
French and Estonian Takuba task force troops, along with soldiers from the Malian armed forces, killed nearly 30 Islamists in the Liptako region of Mali, near the border with Niger and Burkina Faso, according to a statement from the French Army Ministry on Tuesday. The statement also says that equipment and fuel was seized, and that vehicles and about 10 kilograms of explosives were destroyed during the joint operation, which involved ground forces, drone surveillance, and a Mirage 2000 fighter jet. The Malian army also released a statement Tuesday referencing several recent operations, including an operation with a Takuba task force in Ain Daliman, the same locality cited in the French Army Ministry statement. Colonel Suleiman Dembele, a spokesperson for the Malian army, confirmed by telephone that the operation cited in the French statement is the same operation cited by the Malian army. 20 terrorists were killed and several vehicles destroyed, according to the Malian statement, as well as several weapons recovered. The French and European military operations in Mali have grown increasingly unpopular as the country struggles to contain Islamist militant activity. On Monday, Prime Minister Shogo Kokala Maiga said during a meeting with the diplomatic community that the Takuba task force was created to divide Mali, among several other accusations aimed at the French military intervention. French forces arrived in 2013 to help Mali fight militant groups that had taken over the country's north. The Takuba Task Force is a European operation deployed in 2020, made up of about 900 soldiers. The government asked a Danish contingent of the task force to leave soon after it arrived in January. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
And still in Mali, the transitional government announced Wednesday that it had created working groups with members of West Africa's regional bloc, ECOWAS, the African Union, and the United Nations to work toward a return to constitutional order. The West African state was hit hard with sanctions last month after the military junta that first seized power in a 2020 coup proposed extending its rule until 2025. And Libya's interim prime minister Abdurrahman Beiba said he would defy a planned vote in parliament to replace him today, raising the prospect of two rival governments running in parallel. Beiba has repeatedly said that the transitional government of national unity that he heads remains valid despite the collapse in December of a planned election process and has rejected moves by the parliament to take control of it. The World Health Organization says that insecurity and bureaucratic difficulties continue to prevent medical supplies and other crucial relief from reaching millions of beleaguered civilians in conflict-ridden northern Ethiopia. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
An estimated 9.4 million people in northern Ethiopia's Tigray, Amhara, and Afar regions are in desperate need of humanitarian assistance. Millions are suffering from severe food shortages. Acute malnutrition is rising. Disease and chronic illnesses are going untreated. The World Health Organization reports dozens of mobile health and nutrition teams are operating across the three regions. However, treating those in need remains challenging. It says essential medical equipment and medical supplies, vaccines and basic medicines are not reaching the people in need. WHO spokesman Christian Lindemeyer says the situation is particularly critical in Tigray. He says the number of people needing health assistance has risen from 2.3 million during the first half of December to an estimated 3.9 million. However, he says there is what he calls light on the horizon. He notes a shipment of medical supplies reached Mekele, the capital of Tigray, at the end of January. And, he adds, the Ethiopian government has announced it would facilitate daily relief flights to augment the transportation of crucial goods by land.
WHO is preparing to airlift critically needed medicines, medical supplies, and equipment to Tigray. The first shipment of this is expected to be dispatched this Friday, 11 February. When 10 metric tons of the total 33 metric tons of supplies will be airlifted. Most clearances for this have been secured, and the remaining permits will be processed over the next few days.
Nevertheless, he says humanitarian agencies are being forced to downsize their operations because they are running out of supplies, fuel, and cash. He warns these operations may have to shut down in the coming weeks if the situation does not improve. He says an integrated measles campaign at the end of January highlights some of the difficulties aid agencies run into. The campaign, he says, targeted nearly 800,000 children under age 5 using vaccines provided by the Ethiopia Ministry of Health.
And during this phase, 145,000 children of the targeted population were reached because the campaign faced challenges including cash, lack of fuel, and cold chain capacity.
Lindmeyer says WHO continues to negotiate with the authorities for access to the regions. Despite ongoing difficulties, he says some things are moving, and that is a good development. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Cameroonian soldiers killed at least 8 people and burned dozens of homes and shops during 3 separate operations in the country's northwest Anglophone region in December 2021. That's according to Human Rights Watch. Ilaria Allegrozzi, a senior Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch, spoke to Ricky Shryok about the details of the attack.
Yeah, so there have been new human rights abuses by the Cameroonian soldiers recently in December during 3 separate military operations where they killed at least 8 people and also burned and destroyed private homes and shops in the northwest region. These are just the latest of a series of abuses committed by the Cameroonian security forces in a climate of almost complete impunity. And I think that it's actually this impunity which is fueling new abuses and allows for new violations to happen.
Can you tell me more about what organizations, what institutions are supposed to hold these soldiers to account then, and what kind of deep structural issues allow this impunity to continue in Cameroon?
I mean, military abuses in the Anglophone regions have been widespread since the beginning of the crisis in late 2016. Security forces in general have been accused by local and international human rights groups, violations including killings, burning of entire villages and hundreds of homes, disappearances, torture, illegal detention. It's up to the government, to the Cameroonian authorities, to investigate those abuses and hold those responsible to account. Unfortunately, this is not happening. And we, as I said, we are, you know, witnessing a climate of impunity where absolutely, like, no prosecution, no investigation have been opened in these abuses. And that's why, I mean, like, this is really sending a very chilling message to the abusers that they can get away with anything, with murders, with destruction, with torture. And so that's why it's really high time for the Cameroonian authorities to take urgent steps to address this impunity and allow, among other things, also independent human rights monitors to visit the Anglophone regions. So far, the government has most of the time prevented independent monitors, but also journalists to visit the Anglophone regions.
A normal resident in the Anglophone region, what kind of recourse do they have? You know, what does their daily life look like at the in these times?
I mean, generally speaking, civilians in the Anglophone regions have been caught between a rock and a hard place. They've been victimized by both the government forces and the armed separatist groups, who have also committed serious crimes against civilians, including imposing a perverse boycott of education, which has deprived hundreds of thousands of children of their fundamental right to education. So civilians are being caught in the middle between two fires, and they have been left on their own at this time of crisis, where little is done to address their needs and their plight.
That was Ilaria Allegrozzi, senior Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch. She was speaking to Ricky Shryok from Rome. And for our final story, a radio program in Nigeria is helping break through conservative cultural barriers by highlighting cases of gender-based violence, or GBV. Even before the COVID-19 lockdowns, many women and girls were victims of GBV. Timothy Obiezu reports from Jos in Nigeria.
Fatima was on her way home from evening prayer in April 2020 when two armed men assaulted her. As Fatima goes to the shop to learn tailoring, she recalls her experience.
They had a gun to my head and a knife to my throat as they took me into the building. They raped me and they kept taking turns while they were stabbing me during the act.
Every Thursday evening, like many of the residents of Jos, she listens to a radio show where victims of gender-based violence talk about their ordeal. At first, Fatima was too afraid to report her assault to the authorities. Her rapists threatened to kill her if she told anyone about what happened. Fatima eventually broke her silence. She called in to speak with Nanji Nadang, the host of Silent Voices program on the local JFM station. Nadang says the program reaches 100,000 listeners every week.
When they are telling me their problem, they feel like this is a safe space. There are times I go emotional on the show. There are times I go blank, because when you hear some cases, you wonder if we have normal human beings again on Earth, because some people behave like monsters, and it's really disturbing.
To help victims get justice, Nadang works with the International Federation of Women Lawyers, or FIDE. The nonprofit offers free legal representation to victims who report cases on the radio show. FIDE's representative in Plateau State says seeking justice for victims is not easy.
There's so much bottlenecks, so somehow we encounter some delays. But, you know, our presence also gives us a lot of breakthrough. You know, there are cases that ordinary people would report to the police and they are not being given the necessary attention. But the moment they call on FIDE for FIDE's intervention, the moment we appear, the police will hasten the process.
Fatima's rapists have yet to be convicted, but FIDE says it will be monitoring the case. In June 2020, all 36 of Nigeria's state governors resolved to declare a state of emergency over rape and other gender-based violence against women and children. As a part of their initiative, the governors aimed to impose tougher federal laws punishing rape and violence and to set up sex offender registers in all the states. As Nanji Nadang calls attention to GBV, she signs off saying,
"Share your story with me via Silent Voices with Nanji and tell me whatever sexual and gender-based violence issue you're facing."
Authorities say cases have tripled amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Jos, Plateau State, Nigeria.
And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington.